Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
The scope of Peter Ford's life is difficult to sum up simply. A medical student turned journalist, then Sydney-based TV newsreader, before his random selection to anchor CNN News in the US. His fortuitous dabbling in computing on the side while covering some of the world's most significant news stories now sees him as the CEO of a medical science company that uses technology to allow patients trapped inside chronic illness to reconnect with their families and the rest of the world. Peter joins us with his early discovery of the power of innovation and invention through his granddad back home in Australia.
He developed a machine gun sight during the First War. He was a mechanic by, he was an accountant by trade and a mechanic by inclination. And he used to build cars. And I remember as a little kid, there was always some old car that he was rebuilding, and usually from the ground up, and had his own idea of innovation. And also, as anybody who's worked on anything mechanical, whether physical or binary in a programming sense, you always get to some point where you think, oh, this is too hard. I think I'll just put this on the shelf. And he had the quiet and calm perseverance to go through that barrier and then get it done. And I think that's probably a really helpful element to have if you are dreaming. You've got to be able to follow through and get the thing finished.
Peter, the life you're living now in the US is the product of a number of really diverse transitions, starting off with your time as an exchange student there in the States.
That's true. I came over here in 1968 as a Rotary exchange student from the town of Miles in Queensland. And I had already won a Commonwealth scholarship to do medicine, so I was going to go back and do med. I stayed with a family of a doctor, an anesthesiologist, or anesthetist. It was a lovely family. They were just a superb family for me to stay with. And it was 1968, which many news people look back on that year and call it a chasm in time, because so much happened, especially in the U.S. You know, we had all the civil rights riots. We had Martin Luther King was shot. Bobby Kennedy was shot. And then we had Apollo 8. Christmas 1968, Apollo 8 flew around the moon for the first time. Humans traveled around the moon and read from Genesis as they were going around. So it was a massive year in history, both internally and externally. As a result, we were exposed to massive amounts of news. The news anchors like Walter Cronkite and a host of others who may not be known about in Australia, but Cronkite's pretty famous. All these guys were the doyens of delivering the news, and I started to go through this shift from what I was probably an imposed ambition to medicine to what I really found fascinating, and that was, how do you take the events of a massively interesting and changing world and put them in a coherent way so everybody can understand them?
As you commit to journalism, you set yourself an extraordinarily stringent timetable by anybody's standards, a year in press, a year in radio. Then you plan to do television, which turns out to be the case, leading the news coverage for Channel 7, before heading to the US to anchor a cable TV news network there.
Well, I just have to go back one step, Dwayne, because when you said I led news in Australia, I didn't really. I was a novice coming out, but I had two great mentors and examples. The first one was Roger Clemson, who was the lead newsreader on 7 Network, a lovely fellow. Roger and Brian Henderson were the last of the newsreaders who weren't journalists. And that was an evolution in Australian journalism, which was, you know, a normal part of Australian television, but Roger was just such a gentleman. He was a superstar in that environment, and enormously gracious. As I say, a wonderful gentleman, no ego, and very encouraging for anybody who came through. And I actually got my first break on 11 a.m. reading news breaks when Steve Liebman was anchoring 11 a.m. and between those two guys, you know, I had very good guidance and experience, and I was very fortunate to be in their company as I was trying to learn the ropes and see what I needed to do to go to America.
What was the relationship like between Australian television and news and U.S. cable networks, and to what extent was that useful for you?
That's a very good question, because in the revolution that Ted Turner brought about, there was something I did not realize about Australian television or any television in English. It worked like this. Before I went over, I wasn't looking for a job in the States. I actually wanted to go over and study satellites, because I thought if I could learn from somebody like Ted Turner how to do satellite rebroadcasting, I could start a company in Australia and we'd go into the satellite business, because I was brand new then. So I actually wrote to the presidents of news for CBS, NBC, ABC, and CNN, this new upstart network. It was so new, yeah. And the major networks thought it was such a joke, they used to call it Chicken Noodle News, CNN. And I wrote to all these guys, and I got really nice letters back from CBS and ABC. So when I got to New York, the vice president of news showed me around each of the networks and got to see how the big guys did it. How, you know, these were the guns. CBS was the home of Walter Cronkite. Mm. So I went down to Atlanta, and I walked in the front door to come back to your question, Duane, and I walked past the foreign desk, and the foreign editor, whose name is Janae Von Essen, said, "I know you." And I said, "Well, I don't think so. I just got here. I just got here. And she said, no, we've been using your reports for the last 6 months. I said, how? And she said, "Well, you know, CNN was trying to fill so much air, 24-hour news cycle, that they were taking English reports from anywhere on the planet they could find them."
Wow.
And somebody at the Seven Network cut this deal where they just shunted everything over on the satellite, and whatever they had, they put on the air. So, so when I walked in there, they already knew that those reports. And so within 5 minutes, she said, "You were interested in working here." And I said, "Well, I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, sure." She said, "Well, talk to that guy over there." And that guy over there looked like Groucho Marx, carried a .38 revolver in his ankle holster, rejoiced to the name of Mad Dog.
Goodness.
Was a New Yorker. And he was the new president of what was to become Headline News when we went down to cover the first shuttle launches. And when we got there, CBS, ABC, and NBC, the big three broadcast networks, had these huge structures down in the press zone overlooking the launch pad, which is about 5 miles away. Mm. And there were big glass-in ceiling rooms, and they were air-conditioned because Florida's like Brisbane in summer. And they had, you know, all these live cameras, studio cameras set up there. Well, the CNN site was down in the parking lot in front of these three big establishments. And we had a little Winnebago camper van and a couple of lawn chairs on the roof and a camera, a shoulder-held, I think it was a Sony 3000 or something like that, camera on the roof on a tripod. And you had to climb up a ladder and stand in front of the lawn chairs to get to line up a shot of the launch.
Your role as a news anchor on a multinational cable TV network affords you some extraordinary introductions, including meeting at one point Saddam Hussein's foreign minister, just as the world is about to embark on Desert Storm.
That was just after Saddam had crossed the border into Kuwait and alarmed everybody, especially the Saudis, because they didn't think they were ready to handle this. And so a group of us, I was an anchor in Washington, D.C. at the time, about six or seven of us, were invited to dinner at the Iraqi embassy, and Tariq Aziz was the ambassador at the time. For dinners generally in Washington, especially, these kinds of dinners, they have a certain format. They're like formal dances, and you're standing around talking, and you just talk about nothing. Main course, you start defining the things that are going to be discussed later. The host will tell you what's on his mind. And in this case, Tariq Aziz, what was on his mind was the fact that his boss had just invaded Kuwait, the neighboring oil-rich country, and was heading down to Saudi, and he knew the Americans were going to get very unhappy about this. So he was trying to hose down the news. And he was telling us how, you know, Saddam was a peacemaker, and he was the leader of the most peaceful movement in the Middle East, and Baghdad University was one of the most famous and eminent universities in the world, but certainly in the Middle East. And they had a certain degree of claim to that because of their history. But clearly, this is a PR exercise. And then over dessert is what they tell you they want. You know they're going to tell you what they want to come up in the sound bites the next day. And that's when he delivered the actual sound bites about, you know, Saddam not wanting to go any further in Kuwait. And everything was basically, he was an awfully nice fellow, and you know, everybody misunderstood him just because he'd invaded across the border.
Wow.
That was August. I think the next month we flew in with the U.S. Air Force, my cameraman and I, Mike Watley. I mean, we're on a conveyor belt of C-5 Galaxies and C-141 Starlifters going in from Andrews Air Force Base and MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, all heading into what was at the time called an undisclosed airfield in the north of Saudi Arabia, but everybody knew it was Dahran Air Base.
From one desert to another, among your many career transitions, you're also an author writing The Keeper of Your Dreams, a story of Indigenous Australia.
The first the very first version, I apologize, is called the Emu Poison Bush, which is based on an actual bush that grows out in the central desert, which the tribal groups out there, Yanko Chajara, Pichinjara, Lurcha, some of the people in some of those tribal groups will use that to put in water where they know emus drink. And when they drink it, there's a chemical in it which acts like a hallucinogen. And the emus become very clumsy and stagger around, so they're very easy to capture and kill and eat. And it's about a very wealthy collector, and there are a few of them in Australia, who has a particular device, an artifact that he wants to collect, and he arranges for it to be stolen. And this is a story of how they seek to rebalance everything. It's not so much revenge as returning everything to equilibrium. And I wanted to get it right, so I spent quite a lot of time on the research. And then I went out to the desert and sat on the ground around a fire for a week reading this story to two elders, two storykeepers. They said there are three things in there which are secret men's business. You cannot publish the book. And so they banned the book.
Goodness.
And so I had to go back and rewrite it. And I published the first one in hardback at some expense myself, took it off the market, and then went back and rewrote it and they read it. We read it again around the fire. And the second time I read it, they approved it, and then I brought it to the States, and Simon & Schuster published in New York.
Peter, as we turn now to the role that you pursue today with so much excitement, I was trying to get my head around a theme for the decisions you've made in your life to date, that of medical student, then journalist, computer programmer fascinated with satellite technology, in the middle of which you were dabbling with robotics. And it occurred to me, looking at these changes, that you're a man who's passionate about connections, connecting people with their news, connecting the world with each other. And now, with your NeuroSwitch program, connecting people with a world that perhaps they've lost touch with because of disability or injury.
Well, first of all, that was very nice of you and very perceptive of you to make those connections, Duane. And now that you say it, I think that's probably that's a very accurate overview. I guess everybody who does something for a profession, as a professional for a living, as you do, you occasionally in the dark hours think, well, what would happen if I lost my voice, or what would happen if I couldn't do what I'm doing? And I extrapolated that along a number of lines. One of them was I'd read an interview about Professor Stephen Hawking back in the 70s when I was still at university for the third time, I think, in Queensland. I was inspired by his intellect and challenged by the fact that he was in a body that was slowly shutting down, and thought, you know, why don't we just give him the ability to patch his intellect into a mainframe computer? This is before microcomputers, and let him communicate. And that it's amazing what the human brain does, the subconscious does, and it germinated for a while until I was actually writing code and was invited to join this research and development laboratory in Atlanta. And at that point, I thought, we now have a tool with high technology to enable any human to reach out through whatever barriers they have, if their body's shutting down, if they've been paralyzed, if they have a disease like motor neuron disease, if they've been shot, as a number of our clients have been shot. What can we do to send a communication cable into, like mine is trapped in a mine, and get a cord down so they can talk to the rest of the world? And it started out with my first program was to control a computer, an Apple computer, without using the keyboard or a mouse. And this is before the mouse, as we know it, had actually been invented. It was actually an action joystick. Mm. And so that first step was, as you pointed out, it was a collusion of all those influences to communicate, to make a computer program that would enable anybody, the guy who is trapped at the end of the tunnel when nothing else works, to enable anybody to communicate and reach out to the world and say the most important thing any of us humans want to say, and that is, I am here and I matter.
You mentioned Stephen Hawking. You've been working with Stephen underground, for the want of a better term, for a while now, haven't you?
Well, I made contact with him in 1982. I sent an initial program on an Apple over to him from the lab we were working at in Atlanta. And then again in 2002, I was invited to go over and meet him and to show him what I had developed with what was to become NeuroSwitch. And I went in and out to England maybe three or four times a year for the next 5 or 6 years, 2002 to 2007, so nearly 6 years, just working with him on the prototypes. And he was a very tough guy to take your homework to. First of all, he built his own computer when he was 17.
Yeah.
He was still at school. He understood code. And if he didn't like something, he pulled no punches telling you about it. But he also, to his own surprise, found that what we were doing, what I was doing with NeuroSwitch, was extremely useful and enormously powerful, much more powerful than the hand switch he used.
There'll be many of us who are new to your NeuroSwitch technology. How does it work? What does it do?
For somebody whose body doesn't work anymore, who's quadriplegic, who's lost speech, either because of a disease such as motor neuron disease or ALS, or because of a traumatic accident, it might have been a brain injury or a gunshot wound, there are a lot of those coming back from the war zones now. When their body no longer works, there is an area of communication in a rehabilitative environment called assisted technology, AT, assisted technology. And most AT enables a person who can't do most of these things to write words on a screen. But generally, it uses scanning technology. So you'll see, instead of having an actual keyboard that you tap with your fingers, the computer puts a picture of a keyboard up on the screen, and then the computer highlights each row on that keyboard in succession, so the top row, then the second row, then the third row. And if you can tap a button or use a straw to sip and puff or look at a certain place on the screen with your eyes, you can tell the computer when to stop on that row and go across. And once it stops on the row, it starts going from left to right across the row until it gets to the letter you want to print. Now, that seems very onerous and time-consuming, and initially it is, but the computer program also has word prediction, like the word prediction on your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when people's bodies are shut down to a considerable degree is that they can no longer hit a button or use a straw to sip and puff or focus their eyes on one place in the computer. And so I figured that there must be something that we can tap into that would work around that. And what we can tap into is the body's own electrical signals. And if you're listening to this, or Dwayne, if you raise your left hand and close your fingers into a fist, you're actually sending signals from your brain down to those muscles to close your fist.
Yeah.
And you don't really think about sending the signals. You just want to close your fist. But what we can do is track the electrical signal traveling down your neural pathways through the muscles. And we can put sensors on the surface of the skin, non-invasive, painless, and pick up those signals. And then we can use those signals using NeuroSwitch software to turn those into a coherent switch, which will do the same thing as tapping a button. So as I said, it does a really simple thing in a complex way, in a way that hasn't been done before like this, and it enables people who are locked in, or ostensibly locked in, to find a way to interact with the computer again and start typing letters and words and sentences. You can go out on the internet, you can surf the web, you can send and receive emails, you can text people onto their text phones. You can do all of this by just sending a signal to one muscle, even if that muscle doesn't work. And that electrical signal opens up that long mine shaft down which so many people are trapped and lets them reach out into the world again.
The NeuroSwitch website, Peter, has you standing by some of your patients, including an Australian cop, reconnected with their world, and you're absolutely beaming.
You know, I think what you're seeing, Dwayne, is a reflection of what I see in the face of each person as they come online, and they realize that those windows and doors that they've told are sliding shut and are going to be locked are no longer locked shut, that we can wedge those windows open and let them reach out to the world again. And that look that you see in each person's eyes the moment they get that first signal on the screen and it makes a little red flash on the screen, that look is that's the huge aha moment. That's a totally intrinsically and powerfully human moment when they know they can reconnect again.
Peter Ford, it's been terrific catching up. Thank you so much for your time, and all the best with NeuroSwitch.
Thank you, Dwayne. I really appreciate it. It was great to talk to you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.